So, yeah, as far as how did this happen, because I think you asked that somewhere in your string of thoughts, because programmers are lazy. And when they're not lazy, project managers are unreasonable and they want things now and they want it as fast as possible. And they don't care about any security things. They don't care about taking the time to do it right. They don't care about taking the time to actually investigate, like, okay, we're going to use this project to build our code onto. Maybe we should make sure that there's nothing here that we might regret. Well, no, they don't want to do that. They don't want to spend that money on you. You know, they don't want to spend the money on developers.
Right.
I can only assume that they don't like developers and they don't want us to have an enjoyable life because they always tell us to do things that are bad. So I assume that it is an actual personal slight against our profession.
Yeah, perhaps so. Yeah.
Because I mean, this happens so often that I kind of am at the point of like, well, what else am I supposed to assume? You're constantly asking me to do things which I'm telling you are bad.
Right.
And you constantly say, I don't care, you're going to do what I tell you.
Yeah.
So clearly you don't actually, clearly you don't actually respect us as professionals because you tell us to do something, we tell you it's bad, and then you tell us that, no, we don't know what we're talking about. And then the thing happens, and we were right. And then what happens? The next time something comes up, it's like, hey, you remember the last time you tried this? Oh, no, that's different. That's different. So, Jeff, the question on everybody's mind, well, not everybody, but some people's minds.
Some people's minds.
Is... how did Log4j happen?
Yeah.
And I kind of look at it of, how did it not happen?
Kind of, yeah. So I've actually looked at the vulnerability itself. I gave it a quick glance, and I wasn't, didn't look like it was, it's not obvious, but it's not also, it's, how did this not get discovered sooner? I guess is the question I have. And there's a whole shed load of Java tools out there that are using log4j. It's like the I don't want to say it's the default, but if you go, I need to add logging to my thing, which what thing are you building that doesn't need logging? You're probably going to reach for log4j, I think. Or there's probably alternatives out there, and they're probably going to get a lot more press after this. But so there's tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of Java web apps and financial applications and this, that, and the other, and customer-facing applications, and a lot of them are using this service, and they're all, now they all need that upgrade. They all need to be fixed. What are the odds that most of them are not going to be fixed? I'd say pretty high.
No, I think now that this has reached news media, you know, frenzy status, they probably all will. Now, the question is, are they going to be fixed with the actual fix?
Right.
Or are they going to be fixed with the rushed patch, which doesn't actually fix things?
Right, yeah, I liked that very much.
Because
yeah.
I think that's what's going to happen. Everybody's going to patch to that one, and then, okay, we're good. And then, well, yeah, actually, that was no good. I don't know what you're talking about. We got it. We patched. We're good.
Probably. Can't rush your patches, I guess. Of course, also, I think the timeline was, it was only like 2 weeks between first report and someone leaked it on Twitter. Was it the same guy who reported it that posted about it on Twitter? Do you know?
That I don't know. I can probably... pull it up pretty quickly, though.
Just seems like everything about the way this has been done is should have been done better, I guess is a good way to put it. But then that's, I guess that's par for the course for security stuff in general. This should have been done better. You could say that probably about almost every security vulnerability. This should have been done better. There's those uncommon vulnerabilities like, wow, how did you pull this off? That's really amazing. Okay. That requires extreme talent. But a lot of them are just like, you forgot to check for a null or something. Simple things that just got overlooked.
So, yeah. So it was first discovered by Alibaba's cloud security team. They reported it on, let me get my dates right, on November 24th. And then someone from that team then tweeted it out on the 9th and released code.
Brilliant.
Now, that tweet has since been removed, And the GitHub repo that he used to show the exploit code has been removed.
Right.
But it's the internet, so that didn't go away.
Of course
it didn't. I think is why it spread so quick, so fast. And once people realized, oh, this actually isn't super complicated, then people ran with the ball.
Yeah, I think there was like live streamers, Minecraft live streamers, and someone was exploiting the server they were on, and things started happening, I believe.
Yeah, and then once people see how easy it is, then more people want to do it because, I need to get in on this.
Gosh. See, mass scanning activity detected from multiple hosts. Originally, right after the tweet came out, I think, I remember hearing that there were 2 or 3 major sources of scanning traffic. And then practically overnight, 3 or 4, 2 days maybe, and everybody's scanning for this because it's everywhere. There's so much Java code on the web everywhere. It's, okay. I don't know why people like Java so much. I think a lot of developers of Java do it because that's how you make money, right? I want to develop. I don't want to do some of those other stupid languages. Java works. Great. But it just seems like there's so many better ways to make these tools. Why are we still using so much Java? Why? That's not really a legitimate question. But if you want to answer that, why are we still doing that? I would certainly hear what you have to say, because it doesn't make any sense to me. There's far better tools out there.
Okay, so why are we using Java? Because there's so much written in Java, and so many people learned Java in university as their first programming language. Yeah, so that's why Java proliferates.
So we need to stop training people on Java then.
Well,
and that will cause it to die out.
So I don't want to seem like I hate Java, even though I do hate Java.
I don't mind seeing that. I do hate Java. Yeah.
Java has probably one of the most amazing security track records of any technology ever.
Okay.
I mean, if you just look at how many Java vulnerabilities there have been. And that's like at like the open JDK, at the JDK level. I don't know if this was necessarily Java's fault, because, you can write crappy code with C++. That's not C++'s fault because you suck as a programmer.
Well, some people would say it is, but I don't. I'm on board with what you're saying. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I try to blame C++ all the time when I can't do something right. But in honesty, it's because I suck, not because C++ is bad.
I was going to say that. I'm glad you said it first. Thank you.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I'm not a fan of Java, is just because at the language level, there has been so many issues. At one point, when I looked, this was maybe 2011, 12, maybe 13 or 14, I don't know. I looked at, like, the thing with the most cert entries was Java. Like, followed closely by Adobe products, but, that's another rant for another day.
Oh, that's painful.
But,
not a fan.
Yeah, like, Microsoft was down below that. Like, when you're worse off security-wise than Microsoft, maybe you need to rethink your position in life. But anyway, so, I'm not the biggest fan of Java. But it proliferates because so many people know it.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised if 20 years from now, some brilliant researcher doesn't find some weird abstract vulnerability in Python, which, just is utterly destructive. And then, of course, all of us will be all brilliant then. We'll be like, well, why are people using Python? Look how bad it was. Like,
right.
So I want to kind of tamper the, let's bash on Java.
But it's so much parade. Fun.
Right. But I mean, if we're going to bash on,
it's so easy.
If we're going to bash on language, let's not lose our focus. It should always be JavaScript.
Okay. Enemy number one, JavaScript, but there's still lots more entries
there,
on that
list. There are other enemies, yes. But enemy number one is JavaScript and will always be.
Right. Okay. I'm on board with that.
As far as how did this happen? Because I think you asked that somewhere in your string of thoughts. Because programmers are lazy. And when they're not lazy, project managers are unreasonable. And they want things now. And they want it as fast as possible. And they don't care about any security things. They don't care about taking the time to do it right. They don't care about taking the time to actually investigate. Like, okay, we're going to use this project to build our code onto, maybe we should make sure that there's nothing here that we might regret. Well, no, they don't want to do that. They don't want to spend that money on you. You know, they don't want to spend the money on developers.
Right.
I can only assume that they don't like developers and they don't want us to have an enjoyable life because they always tell us to do things that are bad. So I assume that it is an actual personal slight against our profession.
Yeah, perhaps so. Yeah.
Because I mean, this happens so often that I kind of am at the point of like, well, what else am I supposed to assume? You're constantly asking me to do things which I'm telling you are bad.
Right.
And you constantly say, I don't care, you're going to do what I tell you.
Yeah,
so clearly you don't actually,
clearly
you don't actually respect us as professionals because you tell us to do something, we tell you it's bad, and then you tell us that, no, we don't know what we're talking about. And then the thing happens, and we were right. And then what happens? The next time something comes up, it's like, hey, you remember the last time you tried this? Oh, no, that's right. Different. That's different.
That's the kind of thing that gets you fired when you remind them about last time.
Yeah.
Because now you're questioning everything, right? It's one thing to challenge their decision and their ego. It's another thing to bring that back up later as it doesn't need to be discussed again. We'll just put it that way, right?
Yeah, or that was a different situation.
Mm-hmm.
Even when it's literally the exact situation again.
Than those before. Like, no, it's not a different situation. This is a continuation of the last situation because we never actually fixed it. That's happened to me several times.
Right, because once it does blow up, then it has to be fixed as quick as possible. It doesn't need to be fixed the right way. It just needs to be fixed as quick as possible, which usually just creates more problems downstream,
right. Yep.
Which is technical debt, which, I mean, you know, the financial system operates on debt. Apparently, the business system works on IT technical debt as well. I mean,
that's a good analogy.
Maybe we need to make a company that just buys company based on their technical debt, because then we can somehow leverage that into, I don't know. I mean, companies manage to do that with finances. Why can't we do that with, like, IT debt? Because there are so many companies out there that have so much IT technical debt.
But you can't quantify just how much debt you have. And if you did, you'd be scared as hell, right? If we could actually put a quantity somehow, arrive at a single number, like, I know how much debt, I think I know how much debt I have as a company, right? You know, I can go talk to my bean counter, but, like, how much debt do we have right now? But I can't go to a developer, you or me, and say, hey, how much technical debt we have? Because, first of all, the developer will talk my ear off for 3 hours about it all because you finally asked them the key question and
you can't arrive
at a number.
But I think that's how you arrive at the number, is you talk to all your people and say, what are all the problems and all the bad things? And you're going to get a tome that is longer than War and Peace.
Yeah. How many hours do you have?
And then you take that book and you weigh it. And how many pounds does this book weigh? That's your technical debt. And we just do it by actual weight. We could do it in kilograms too. You know, I don't mind metric.
So we've got pounds TD, right?
Yeah. Like, our report has determined that, you know, your company has 16.2 kilograms of technical debt. And then you can put a price tag to that of, well, how much developer time would be the average to resolve one page of technical debt?
Right.
And then you average that over, you know, how much is a page weigh, then all of the, and you come up with a figure like that.
Sure. That sounds like it'll work great. Yeah. There's absolutely no ways to get that wrong. And it's completely deterministic. Every time you'll always get the same answer. Yep.
Well, I mean, it's going to be about as accurate as anything that, you know, a lot of project managers come up with.
That's not saying much though.
You know.
Right? That's not saying, okay. Let's evaluate.
I mean, a broken clock is still right twice a day.
So is it really the project manager that, okay, project manager needs to know about these things. And a good project manager will be planning ahead and thinking about the future. But at the end of the day, the project manager, they're supposed to manage the project. Reducing technical debt fall under managing the project or something else?
Okay,
it seems
so
like maintaining.
First, there needs to be a caveat that not all project management people are bad.
Correct.
I know some that are absolutely fantastic. I also know some that I swear they escaped from Dante's Inferno and they're here to torture us. The project managers that I know personally that are fantastic, they actually keep tabs on like that kind of technical debt. When something comes up and there's a design decision or, you know, there's a business decision and the developers are like, hey, this is not good. Like, they will take that data. They will take that information. They will make a note of it. And then they will follow back up later of, okay, what is it going to take to fix this down the road? Because we're going to have to deal with it. What is that going to take? Now, you run into the problem in some businesses, and this also depends on corporate structure, of how much authority does the project manager actually have?
Right, yeah.
In some businesses, the project manager doesn't have much authority. So, you know, they manage the individual project or whatever, and they have to get, you know, approval from the director of engineering or whatever on allocation of resources and time for whatever. In other companies, you have effectively the project manager being the person who decides the direction of the company and all of the company's projects. Those are the ones that, in my experience, are the train wrecks, because those are the people that I more often than not, so 51% of the time, find in those positions are people that do not come from a technical background. They come from a business background.
Right.
And they've been an executive for a long time, and they don't actually deal with the situation in the trenches. They deal with business moves and, you know, what the IT industry is doing, and they need to position the company accordingly. And, you know, what the poor souls in the trenches are dealing with doesn't matter to them.
They're fungible, really. They're just replace you with somebody else. You don't matter. Your ideas don't matter.
How many developers did we lose this week? Like, you know, it's, we made 10 feet on the plan towards conquering the next trench or whatever. Those are the ones where it turns into a horrible situation. And anytime I've ended up under somebody like that, if I've been able to, I get out as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. Because it's a train wreck. They're going to make your life miserable.
Yep.
Find somewhere else. Now, I understand
what's going to happen is work leaks over into non-work in those situations too, because they haven't really done adequate whatever, right? And then all of a sudden, security vulnerabilities. If your product is not public facing or something, then maybe you don't experience this, but almost always, because of poor project management, I have to work after hours of some way. After hours on a weeknight, or be called because something broke on a Saturday, or something, right? Because project manager didn't have foresight to know this is coming, or didn't have the desire to listen.
Okay, so that gets us back into the whole work-life balance issue, which we've still not had an episode on. Okay. Because, a failure to prepare on your part does not constitute an emergency on my part. This is my weekend. I work during the week. I am, contracted to work, roughly X amount of hours. Like, yeah, it's going to go over. It's not going to be perfectly 40 every week. But when you call me up on a Saturday night and you're like, hey, you need to get in and do this. No, I don't.
Yeah.
Like, no.
Nope.
My job, this is not in my requirements. Like, now, if you have on-call time, then okay, you have to do that. But if you don't have on-call time in your contract, no, I'm sorry. I don't have to do that. And especially when this is a situation you've told them is going to happen, and they said, I don't care what you have to say, you're going to do it my way, and then that blows up. Like, no, I told you this was going to happen. It has happened. This is not my emergency. If you want it to become my emergency, then, you need to call whoever in the company. And you need to authorize, like, I've done this when I've contracted with other places. And yeah, as a contractor, you kind of have a little more leeway, but you're going to bring me in at this hour for who knows how long. This is a special situation. I'm not getting out of my bed unless this is the dollar amount you're agreeing to. And 9 times out of 10, that will get shot down real quick.
Yep.
Because basically what they want is, and I'm going to say it as harsh as I can, they want somebody that they can push around. They want somebody that they consider to be a chump that they don't respect to come in and clean up their mess that they don't want to take responsibility for.
Okay, I don't think it's always that way, though. Well, there's sometimes I've been in some situations where they were legitimately fearful, like they realize how exposed are we or something. And so it's not just, I want someone I can order around. I don't know a way out of the situation that we find ourselves in, of course, forgetting that the reason we're in the situation is their decisions.
And I think that's the distinct point, is when it is something that they have arrived at because they have refused to allow development to do what development needs to do, what development knows is correct, what development knows has to be done, and how it needs to be done. When they override that, this is all on you, because you haven't let us do our job. Now, when we're off, you want us to do our job. That's not how business works. That's not how employment works.
It can. It unfortunately does a lot in our business.
It can if you allow it to.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And again, yes, there are situations where this will completely broadside an organization. And yeah, you can decide, okay, I'm going to take one for the team. But what does that teach? That teaches the people in charge, oh, well,
it's
great.
Okay to
next
do
time
we
have this, I know yeah. I can call this guy at Saturday at 10 o'clock at night, and he's going to come in and spend 6 to 8 hours redoing this in the middle of the night. I'm going to go to sleep because I don't care because he's going to handle it. Now it's all on him. Now they know they can get away with it. So then they're going to do it again.
That guy that was doing the 68 hours, and I don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
I learned, finally. It took a while. But no, but okay, there's a lot of fear in our business also that I can't say no. Because if I do say no, they'll fire me and hire somebody else that's cheaper than me, and they won't even blink.
So right? I don't know about in your specific case, but I know in a lot of cases, and I would guess even in your case, yeah, they might threaten to fire you. That's a decision they're going to regret 24 hours later and then realize, probably. Okay, we had a little hole that we tripped in that, you know, we twisted our ankle. And because we wanted to deal with, you know, this little tiny hole, we brought in a backhoe that just dug a hole 20 feet deep. And now we have nobody to do the job because right. nobody else here can actually do this job. And we just fired the one person who could because we had a little temper tantrum. Because he actually wanted to have a life outside of work.
Mm-hmm. So I think if you know, hopefully you know that you're vulnerable to this one person, right? If you're in charge, at least if you don't, or if you've never done this exercise, stop, evaluate what all the things are that are being done by all of your people. Does everything that's being done able to be done by somebody else, right? Bus factor. I've been using this term a lot at work. It gets laughs, but it's the term I've always known. Like if I get hit by a bus, all of my knowledge goes with me into the afterlife. So all the things that are not out of my head and in somebody else's head are ideally written down on paper or even more ideally automated. All those things are just gone.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you're in charge of a project and you haven't done this yet, stop and figure out your bus factor on all the important things. It's self-frustrating when I'm like, I told you, this is a bus factor of one, and now there's nothing you can do about it.
There are so many businesses that operate on a bus factor of one.
It's scary, honestly. I bet a lot of our listeners work for situations like that.
There are a ton of businesses that, you know, the organization itself might have, let's say, 100 people in it. But realistically, it's 4 or 5 people that carry the whole company.
Right.
And I've seen this... with places that friends have worked where, you know, they were just getting destroyed at work, overworked, hammered, not respected, you know, just constant things dumped on them left and right. And it's like, okay, first off, they're not even paying you appropriately for what you do, let alone the fact that they're dumping all of this crap on you and you're working overtime. Like you should be making double what you're making already.
Right,
just to do what you're doing. With all the right. extra pressure, with all the overtime, with all the other stuff that they dump on you, you should be making then more on top of that. But you're not. And, you know, one of my friends, year after year, like, dude, seriously, you are not being treated well here. Like, you are worth way more. You can go somewhere else. Not only have a better life, you'll make more money, you'll be less stressed, all of this. And, like, continually say it and continually say it. And then eventually an opportunity came up. They decided, okay, I'm gonna take this. 2 years later, the company was done because they brought somebody in. They couldn't do it. And everything just got mismanaged and mishandled all the way down until eventually the company just folded because they couldn't do it.
It took that long, frankly, a lot of times
because of contracts and stuff. There's a lot of companies will have contracts for, you know, a year term. So they've got a good year already in the can, so to speak. So even if they screw things up, you know, if you have a system that's running, it'll still run on autopilot for a good while.
Yeah, usually.
It's when anything needs to change or you have major differences or you need improvements or stuff like that, that it starts to fall apart.
Right.
You can coast for a good while, you know, promising your clients.
On a well-designed system.
Yeah.
Right?
You can promise your clients, oh, well, don't worry, this is only temporary. We're going to get this cleaned up and, you know, roll that forward and keep trying to, you know, promote and keep the company going. And you can float it for a good while.
Right.
But you're not going to be able to float it forever. And I think floating for 2 years in some companies isn't that really a challenge, depending on how much constant business they already have.
Yeah. I guess I've been in some situations where things were so fragile, like the fact that they worked at all was Herculean effort by several devs every time, mm-hmm. you know? And it's just like, oh, you can't keep relying on this guy. He's already pulled it online, and now you ask him to do it again. You can't do that to this guy. And then I'll go talk to that guy and be like, why are you doing this? You know, this isn't going to make the situation better. You're perpetuating that it's okay for them to do this. And he's like, no, there's nobody else to do this. I'm like, I get that. And that's a management problem. Management needs to fix that, not you. You don't have the clout to go hire somebody to do what you're doing so that there's two of you. You don't. So you're basically telling them it's okay that you're not hiring somebody else by choosing to work these extra hours and there's nobody else. You're telling management this is okay. And it's not. Now, we have a major problem on top of the other problems if you don't even recognize that this isn't okay. Some people just are convinced this is the way it is, right? Or they're just, maybe they were, I don't want to say wired to be exploited, but there are certainly like degree mail programs where you come out and you're an exploitable dev thing that doesn't really matter. And that's just what it is. And you're going to take your job, get your paycheck, get abused. That's just the way it is. You know, you're a developer, you're great, whatever. It's not very self-actualized. There's actually a lot of people in our business like that, unfortunately. But, you know, it's a better leaving than, I don't know, a lot of other... You get to sit in a nice air-conditioned office. Well, nowadays you get to sit at home. There's, as far as, if I have to eat crap all day long as far as a job, you could do far worse than this.
Yeah, and see,
you could do far better, too.
Yeah, and you know... The way I look at it is if you deal with 8 hours of absolute shit, well, that's 8 hours. Maybe it's 10 hours, whatever. The rest of your day belongs to you. It does not belong to your company.
Correct.
You have a life. You also work. Work is not your life.
Well, a lot of people are trained the other way around.
I know. And that's a problem.
Yeah.
And I think companies really like it when people have that attitude because they're an exploitable workforce. And the problem is it's not just the individual people suffering, but it's also the entire industry. Because if you have two people that are doing their job and half of someone else's job, they're actually taking away someone else's career.
Yeah, actually.
Because if they both said, no, I'm doing what my actual job is, I'm doing my 8 to 10 hours of work every day, so is this other guy, you need to hire someone else. If you're fine with then, oh, no, I'll just work an extra 4 hours right here and an extra 4 hours the next day and an extra 4 hours. And both of you do that. You're literally taking food off of someone else's plate who could have a job.
Yeah, I agree.
But people don't look at it from that aspect. They look at it of, well, you know, it just needs to be done. Well, yeah, it needs to be done. And the way it needs to be done is they need to bring in someone else.
I have this problem, actually. I like to work. We've talked about this. You've ranted about, you've gotten on to me for working too much. And I've cut back on that actually quite a lot. I hadn't had time since we've been moving and everything is up, you know, overturned, right? So I've cut back on that a lot, but I like what I do, you know? And so it's easy for me to like, this happened last week or yeah, I guess it was this past week. I was working on something. I was like really in a groove and I was enjoying myself. I was making good progress and I worked on it at the office. I was there till 9:30. I was like, oh crap, it's 9:30. I need to go home. I liked it, but this definitely falls into what you're talking about here. I'm working more hours. It would be better if we had another person that would be there to help me do this, right? But I don't know where to draw the line there.
Well, okay, I don't want it to seem like I'm saying, you know, the clock strikes.
Don't work extra.
Yeah. Well, the clock strikes whatever hour and, you know, you're out. Like, no, if you're in the zone, like, go for it. But then there needs to be an allowance of, okay, you worked an extra 4 to 8 hours this day. Well, you're going to take off 4 hours early the next day or whatever.
Right.
So that you can balance it out so that you're working an appropriate amount.
Yeah.
When you get your salary, those salaries are based on working 40 hours a week.
Right.
And a lot of companies, if you actually dig into the paperwork of how your salary is actually what it is, they will give you your hourly rate or what it's equal to. So
that's what they do.
And
they build 40 hours at that rate.
It's billed on 40 hours. So when they then go, no, the standard is 60. No, the standard isn't 60. The standard is 40.
According to your accounting, it's 40. Look at that.
And if you want it to be 60 hours, okay, well, you need to pay me 60 at that dollar rate. Well, they don't want to do that because they've calculated that dollar, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It seems so easy, especially... Every company nowadays is talking about work-life balance, right? The interviewers are talking about, we want you to have work-life balance.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get in, and there's no balance.
Yeah, that's so like, just because they're trying to put a shiny coat of paint on all the rust.
Polishing that turd.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, we got to make it look good enough and take away the smell enough for somebody to actually accept this turd. And then, oh, now they're holding the bag. Okay, great. You know, which that's definitely exploitative, first of all. If your industry is reliant upon misdirection to succeed, maybe misdirection is not the right word, just flat out lying, maybe your profession shouldn't exist if it requires it, or your field. And I know that there's honest ways to make software, right? But it seems like so much of the software shops are exploitative. So many of the companies that are doing this, or they'll hire a dev team or whatever. It's just, it's built on exploitation.
Okay. So it doesn't have to be that way.
It doesn't have to be.
But it comes down to that because the people in charge want to make more money for themselves. And like, I mean, I understand that, but yeah, you're screwing over other people to try to accomplish your goal.
Well, there's a fundamental incompatibility. Like I actually had a conversation with somebody about work-life balance a couple years ago, and the conclusion was, well, if we're doing what you're suggesting, we won't make money. I'm like, okay. Like, why is that? Well, we're already competing with other people in this space, and we can't charge more than X, we think. So it's like, it's not economical for them to make this product, except if they're exploiting people. That's not okay.
Okay.
Maybe their product shouldn't exist.
I've heard places that I've contracted with make this argument before. And again, I can only speak from personal experience. But the ones where they have made that claim have been ones where the financial distribution inside the company were stacked all wrong to begin with.
Yep.
You know, you have 14 executives and, you know, management personnel, and two devs people and an ops guy. And they're like, no, we have to have you work all this time because we just can't afford it. Like, what exactly are all you people doing in your offices all day?
Right.
Because clearly you're not doing anything work, because if there's 14 executives and management people, A, how do you have five employees that are actually doing all the work? Like, how does it take that many people to manage five people or six people? Like, it doesn't. So what's going on here? Now, obviously, that doesn't apply in every situation.
Right.
But, you know, I take a very dim view when an executive makes a comment about how, oh, we can't afford something, when I can see the disparity between how the business is structured for positions.
What's bringing the most value? And shouldn't that thing that's bringing the most value be paid the most? What brings more value, the guy who writes your software or the executive?
So that's kind of a touchy thing.
You
because,
can't really declare that.
Yeah. Yeah, because, okay, let's say you have two developers that make 100K a year, and they write software, so the cost is 200K, and they write software that the company can then sell for, I don't know, 50K, let's say, for a year.
Okay.
So they need four customers.
At least, yes.
At least, to break even. And then they have the executive who makes, let's say, 200K. He makes equal what the two developers do. Well, if that executive pulls in 100 sales, clearly he deserves to be paid more because he's the guy that turned the product into $5 million worth of sales.
Right, yeah.
You know, yes, the
developer... Quick math there. Hang on a second. Quick math.
Yeah. So, like, yes, the developers were the ones actually writing it. And I'm not saying developers shouldn't make money, obviously. But the value that the company as a whole was able to generate, the executive was the one that was able to create the additional value of the product that the developers made. So that's not really a one-to-one. You can't technically compare. The problem comes in when the values start to skew wildly away from realistic. You have, let's say, again, to keep numbers simple, 10 developers making 100 grand. Okay, so there's a million there. And you have two executives, and those two executives are making $10 million apiece.
Gosh.
Like, now you've got like a, whoa, hold on. Like, this is a very big, you know, divergence. And depending on the company and depending on how it's structured and depending on, you know, how many middle management people you have and all this stuff, companies can end up with a lot of weight that doesn't actually add to it.
I agree.
If you have someone who is actually providing value, like in the first example, where you have the executive who's making the sales, that's bringing value to the company. When you have the developers who are writing the code, well, that brings value because then that gives this executive to then sell something. middle management is where things start to break down, because you have people in the middle that aren't actually doing anything other than trying to help the other people. And that's, they do a great job and they can serve a great purpose. But over time, that center band seems to get filled with people that have fallen up to their level of incompetence.
Yes.
To where they can't really do anything else and they're not really good at what they do, but they're making a lot more money because they've been in it for a while.
Yeah. Suppose so.
And then you run into the problem of, well, you run into a lot of problems at that point.
Right. I was going to say, just one? Really?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, okay, so business and economics are just difficult in general because there's so many ways that money goes in and out and how each person actually contributes. And it's very complicated and very messy. And the other problem is you don't want a company to look to go, okay, well, this person doesn't do anything that actually produces value that we can sell, therefore it's not important, because that's right. Exactly how we end up in all these security nightmares. Because yes, they go, no, we don't want to spend money on developers and security personnel to actually make sure the product is good, because that's a lot of money we're spending and we can't sell that. We can't make any extra money off of that.
Yeah, it only makes our development process slower.
It makes our development process more expensive because we're hiring 2 to 3 extra people that isn't making any more. We're not getting more code made.
Right.
So we're now spending more to make the same level of code.
Right.
And it's seen as a negative.
It's easy to see how that gets cut. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's overhead. That's all overhead. The same way IT gets cut whenever there's a budget squeeze. IT is usually one of the ones that they look to cut.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over the last, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years, you've worked at the same company, let's say, and there's only so many times you can go and cut IT before it becomes cut so far that it starts impeding your ability to make anything else happen, right?
Well, then you just outsource it.
Yeah, I've been in that situation too, and that did not go well. But I was told, when I would ask questions about it, I was told, like, you could, we let one person go, and then we can hire 6 people from another part of the world to replace that one person for the same cost. I'm like, but are they going to be as good as the one person? Like, all combined, all their effort, is it going to be as good? Right? And I know it's easy for us to sit here and rant from the position we are in. But it also, there's a lot of people, like, and especially working on dev teams, where you may not have any idea. You think because you're a developer, you know how the sausage is made. But I'd say that the sausage factory is actually over in sales, right? So I work on a dev team. There's 10 of us. We make this product. I don't know how it gets sold. I don't know who it gets sold to. Well, I have a vague idea because we have to make database entries for them or something, let's say. But I don't know how things get sold. I don't know how for much. Like, so I can't make the evaluation myself, and no one would really want me to. Well, I'm more valuable than that executive because, look, he's not post-selling anything. He's not doing anything. No one wants that, right? That's not my responsibility as a developer. But it sure is hard not to notice. And the same guy just calls meetings all day long. And I was like, what are you actually doing? What are you facilitating? It's, you know, I had an entire, we all quit, basically. We had a team of 6, we were operations, actually. We all quit. They took the guy who was our manager of our team and moved him sideways and then replaced him with some, I don't even know what to call him. He did not belong in that position. And inside of 3 months, we'd all quit. It was just that bad. And I believe to this day that he was put in charge because they wanted to empty up the team and replace them with their people. Right? It was one of those situations where we were a team, company gets bought, someone else comes in, new CIO, they want their people, right? So I don't want to fire you, but I do want you gone. So I'll just make your situation uncomfortable, right? I think that was going on. But I didn't know. In that situation, that was operations. It's easy to see, okay, if we're down, we can't run those processes. We're losing $15,000 a minute or whatever, right? You know, it's relatively easy to see that. As a developer, it's not always, you can't always see that. I may have some vague idea that we're selling this product for $40,000 a year for a yearly license to enterprise customers. But I don't know how that actually translates to value. And especially if you're like early in the process of building a product, you may not know. So let's say a lot of the numbers of you could actually, I as a developer could actually know my worth compared to somebody else because we've been selling this product for 10 years, right? Let's say in that situation, you could do it more easily. But if you're on a new dev team or you're working on a young product or a new offshoot of some young product, you don't have any data to work from, you can't really make that assessment. And I go back to, it's not even really your responsibility. But it's difficult to be a developer on a team that's being exploited and not have those thoughts. It's difficult to not go, why is that guy here? What does he do? If we replaced him with someone that actually did something, think of how much far more ahead we'd be, right? If we have to have useless people, why don't we make them useless people security, right? If you're going to have overhead, let's get security useless people in here instead. They won't actually be useless.
Let's also be very clear. You said security useless people, not useless security people.
Correct.
They're just as bad.
Yes, exactly. No, I said security useless people. Yes.
So this is a situation that I think revolves around transparency in an organization. And, mm-hmm. you know, as a developer, you don't know how the sales team works. Obviously, you're not a sales guy. The sales guys, they don't know what developers do. Like, they know what developers do. They don't know how developers do it. They don't know what's going on. Right. They just know, yeah, you guys churn out stuff and we sell it. Like, you know, there's a detachment there. There's always going to be a detachment there. But I found in places that I've contracted, when the company is open, you know, the sales guys can actually, if they're, the company is sadly using Jira, could actually open up Jira and look and go, holy crap, there's like 1,000 tickets here that these guys are working on constantly. Instead of it just, oh yeah, they just like write code or something and then I sell it. Like now they can go, oh, holy crap. Like they can actually see that people are constantly doing stuff. They might not understand it, but they can see, okay, yeah, those guys are hustling all day long. And vice versa. When, you know, when the devs can see that the sales guys, you know, into the whatever the company happens to be using. I actually knew a company that was using Jira for tracking sales and stuff, which was, that was interesting. But it actually worked for them. So like somebody could actually open up the sales, you know, project and see everything and go like, holy crap, these sales guys are like making phone calls all the time and they're doing this and they're doing this and that, you know, they're researching this because a customer asked and they need to find out if that's even something we can do. Like when developers then see that, they're like, oh, these guys are actually busy. Like they're good. And as long as you know the people are busy and they're actually doing work, that animosity doesn't build. When you have siloed stuff, you can end up with developers who are looking at, say, let's pull out our favorite punching bag, the marketing team, and go, there's like 8 people on that marketing team, and they like put out a blog post once a month, and they tweet like twice a day. How is that 8 people's work? Because you can't see anything else. That marketing team may be doing a ton of stuff, but when it's obscured and all you see is the final product, from the developer's point of view, it's just like, okay, a blog post and 2 tweets. I could do that on my lunch break.
And for the sales guy's point of view, the same thing with the developers.
Yeah, the marketing.
You spent 3 months to make the next version, and all it does is it has an extra spreadsheet function in it. What?
Yeah.
Why did this take 3 months and 12 of you? What happened?
Right.
Right?
Whereas when
it's easy to go all the way.
Right. When that's opened up and people can actually see that the other people in the company are actually working, that animosity doesn't build. But that is 100% a management issue.
Well, I think there's people that just, this is, you're working here, take it on faith that things are right. Well, yeah, but I see fruits of it not being right, so now I need to know. So if a company is being open about that stuff, a lot of people won't care.
Yeah, well, they'll have the thought of like, these guys really doing anything? And, you know, they'll spend the hour or two to poke around, and then they'll go, oh, damn, they are. Yeah. Okay. And then it's done, and it's out of their mind, and that's not going to continue to fester. Because it's when it festers that then you get intra-company conflict between departments, because the departments actually feel they are literally in competition with the other departments for resource dollars and, you know, attention and praise and all that. And
well, there are some management styles that are doing that deliberately.
When you hit that point, you're destroying your company. You might get some short-term boost, but let's be clear, there's a difference between friendly competition and actual animosity.
Okay,
like, for instance, you know, I was in the military, and the different branches, we rag on each other all the time.
Right.
Like, all the time. Like, the things I have said about Marines, oh, man, I would not repeat them on this podcast. But if I was ever in, you know, a hot combat zone, and a Marine comes up next to me, dude, he and I, we've got each other's backs. And we know we've got each other's backs. Like, all that ribbing, all that teasing, all that mockery, all that hostility, it was in good faith, because when the actual rubber hits the road, we know we've got each other's backs.
Yeah. I think I have felt that way once about a sales team or a sales guy. Just once in however many years I've been working. I'm always so divorced from it, honestly, I think there's a lot of people that disagree with what you're suggesting and what I'm agreeing with, that information doesn't need to cross silos, that it's okay to silo. Like, maybe we don't want our dev teams to be siloed so much, but certainly dev team and sales or dev team and marketing, because marketing hates dev hates marketing usually. And I wonder if sales and marketing hate each other. I wonder if we could start a war there. Would that work?
I don't know. You know? Let's not. Let's stay on topic.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, staying on topic. So there's a lot of people that you don't need to know this. Or I'm firmly in the camp that it helps me to know. Because, like you're saying, I have some curiosity and I can go investigate for myself and that seed of doubt will be resolved. But if you're deliberately hiding information from me, or you don't think that it's necessary for me to know any of those things, I'm going to have my doubts. Because I'm not just paying attention to what's immediately in front of me. I'm also looking at everything around. I can't help it.
Yeah, and there's a difference between a company taking the stance of, look, you don't need to know that, and a company taking the stance of, you can't know that. You're not allowed to know that. Like, those, they may seem similar at first glance, but those are very, very different things.
That's a good point, yeah.
I know some people will say, well, the teams don't need to mix together. That's just ridiculous. And in my experience, I have seen perfect examples where having openness between the teams can actually do amazing things. Like, for instance, when I have had a sales question before with a company, and I approach the company salespeople and I'm talking to them and I ask them a question, when that sales guy can literally loop a developer in on the call. Mm-hmm. And go,
that's powerful.
Tell me, explain this to me. And he can then go and explain, like, when I know a company is that linked internally and that well oiled, that it is not a problem for a sales guy to bring an engineer on a call, these guys are working well together. And if they're working
well, no, we're not talking about like technical sales guy. We're talking about legitimately one of the developers or the engineers.
Right.
Yeah.
When you have a company that works that well internally, I have faith in the product that they build because clearly they communicate inside.
I just don't see that a lot, though.
You don't.
It's so uncommon. And is that, I could speculate many reasons why, but when's the last time that's happened to you, that you worked at the company that you were able to, you had an experience like that? Honestly, how long has it been? The fact that you're having to stop and think about it is concerning.
Well, no, because there's a recent example that I have of this where I was dealing with support, which is, it's a little closer than sales. But it's still a distinct organization from the development team.
Right. Yes.
But it's with Capture One where, you know, I've had a bug. Yeah. I ran into it. I reported it. The support guy got back and they're like, yeah, we don't know. Like, can you give us more information? So I did like screen captures and sent all this. They then they sent it to the dev team. The dev team, you know, worked around on it. And then long story short, eventually we had a call about it where, once the support person realized that I did development, he's like, oh, hold on. And he just got a guy on the phone so that we could actually talk back and forth. Now, I don't know .NET, which is what it's written with, but I know programming enough that I can be like, look, I think I've isolated the problem down to something in this class, which is doing it. And then granted, it's a closed proprietary software, so I can't see.
Right,
but he can then go in and be like, looking at that, no, it's definitely not that. But you did mention this, so that might be over here. Hold on, let me go check this.
Mm-hmm.
And we eventually did kind of narrow it down to where we think the problem is, but they weren't able to reproduce it on their side. But there were additional versions that came out since that happened that have lessened the impact of the issue. So,
okay,
you know, all right. There's been progress. But again, the fact that it wasn't just, I'm dealing with support guy who's working off a script, you know, I can actually have that connection. And when I'm working with the support or whoever in the company, and they can reach out to someone else in the company and bring them in to help resolve the problem. Like, that makes me not want to move to another company, like, for instance, Adobe, because, well, you don't get that from Adobe.
No, you don't.
Like, you can file the ticket. Congratulations, you filed the ticket.
It goes into a black hole, as far as you can tell.
Yeah.
Ticket? What's that? What?
So as far as sales and getting an engineer on, it probably would have been... probably would have been back in like 2014, 15. And the reason I say that is because that's when I actually stopped doing that kind of contracting. So I haven't been in this position where that would have happened.
Okay, that's fair then. So it's not fair for me to say that you had to think about it.
Yeah.
That the reason you're thinking about it is because it's not recent because you haven't had the opportunity for it. It makes sense. Okay. All right, so...
but again, this all comes down to a management style and how the company is actually structured.
Right. I wonder, so there's been a lot of devs, a lot of heads-up devs that kind of pay attention to everything around, not just focusing on their work. And I sometimes wonder, all right, so when I talk to other devs, we all kind of have the same opinion about that executive or this guy. If one of us were in charge and we changed that, I mean, I wonder how it would go. They do these little thought experiments. Mm-hmm. Like, would any of us actually be able to do okay in a position of power so that we could make the decision to get rid of that useless dude, right?
Well, again, without knowing what that useless dude actually does,
right,
he might not actually be useless. It might just be that he's an idiot when it comes to direction of the dev teams and then engineering teams, and he's actually really good at his job. He just should not have power and control to dictate what this other team does.
Right. See, in the last 5 years, I've been much more cognizant of that, but it's up to 2014, 2015, 2016, somewhere there. I just really had a very negative view of management and people that didn't understand what we were doing. I guess I expected everybody to be able to understand what we were doing. You didn't have to do it with me, but you did need to understand what we were doing, how we were doing it. And if you didn't, I was like, oh, well, okay, whatever. Kind of write them off. But I realized that there's a lot of things that I just don't understand in a company that how this is done. And someone else, and also it could be these useless guys, maybe they have the connection into our biggest client or right. something. Like this guy who's useless and just sits around and comes into work drunk half the time, he's actually the nephew of the owner of that company, and that's the reason we get $2 million in sales from them. So this guy who costs us $150,000 gets us $2 million in sales. Okay, that's good. Mm-hmm. He can come in, and as long as he's not too disruptive, go be drunk somewhere.
Yeah,
great. And maybe we can even get some work out of him. Who knows? There's some things that are like that. It's who you know. But there's not enough visibility a lot of the time. So let me ask this: if we were starting to provide visibility between those teams, right, with the idea of understanding what everybody's role is, it sounds like you would care about what other people's roles are. And I would care more than I used to.
So I don't necessarily care what people's roles are, as long yeah. as there's the understanding that I know that this person is actually doing whatever their role is. Because okay. one of the problems with siloed operations is it just allows people who are leeching on the system to continue to leech on the system.
Yeah.
Because they can hide and they can, you know, if they happen to be on a team with people that really like them as a person, those people will kind of like cover up for him and give, you know, he's been doing some yeah. good work, but you know, he's dealing with blah, 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 blah. So that they are able to get away with not doing anything or doing very little. And of course, again, you have the people who kind of drift, and we talked about this before with Herb, they kind of drift between separate teams so that they're not actually yep. doing anything. And again, when you have an open organization, somebody who's not on either one of those teams can sit back and go, hold on a second, this right. looks a little suspicious.
Right.
I don't think there's many, maybe that's the wrong way to put it, but I'll put it that way anyway. I don't think there's many valid reasons to argue against openness like this in an organization like an engineering firm, you know.
Well, I was thinking that too until about 10 seconds ago when I had thought, like, some things like sales numbers, maybe those shouldn't be shared.
But sales numbers sales numbers is entirely different than knowing that the sales team is actually doing sales and not right. just doing lines of Coke at TGI Fridays every Thursday.
Well, they could be doing both, but as long as they're doing the sales,
right,
maybe everybody else looks the other way for those,
you know,
those
when you know people yeah. are constantly engaged and constantly working, that's what's important. Because
right.
when you think that, you know, okay, let's punch on the sales team. When you think there's people on the sales team that are literally just sucking down a paycheck and going out to expensive lunches and not doing anything, you get pissed off.
I do. Yeah.
But if you knew that, like, no, they're actually working. Like, yeah, they did a couple expensive lunches and that led to a $4 million sale. Like, okay. Right. A couple $50 lunches, it's worth $4 million. You know, yeah, okay. Right. You don't need to know the figures, but like if you know the person is actually busy. Because yeah. I think especially in this field, because a lot of software engineers are very technically minded, they can kind of sniff through BS and they can also kind of see where like this guy isn't doing stuff. And if they can at least just take the time on a lunch break to actually see that, oh, okay, he's actually got a huge ticket stack and he is doing stuff, then it's okay, fine. But when you don't know, when that person has a wall up and resists any attempt to pull that wall yeah. back, then you're like, why are you so worried about me seeing what your ticket stack is?
This is what the thing Herb used to do.
Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, I filed a ticket for you to do something that I know takes 10 minutes at most. It's been open for 6 months.
Right.
And this has been
an
issue.
There's only so many excuses you can make.
Like, right. I had to work 4 extra hours the last 3 days. Like, you couldn't pull 10 minutes in the last 6 months? Like, what's going on there?
Although now you're talking about the going over the work-life balance. The assumption here is that the person that didn't do this is a leech, right? I think what I've been realizing here is that it's just my disgust over leeches in your office that's really leaking over into this conversation. And I see them everywhere. I tend to see them more often on, say, like a sales team or marketing or something like that. That's not a hard technical science is making a product.
Yeah, the reason kind of I bring up that work-life balance issue is because when you are at a company who is pushing the, no, we need to do this. You got to work extra. Meanwhile, the guy in marketing can't work 10 minutes extra. Like, yeah. No, clearly the business motivation here is not, we've got to get this stuff done. If you expect me or, you know, the other engineers to do an extra 20 hours every week, the marketing guys, 10 minutes is too much to ask over a 6 month period. Like, that works out to like, what, a couple seconds a day, maybe, if you averaged it out.
Yeah, that's the stopping to breathe one extra breath right. Kind of thing, right? Just stay at your desk, breathe twice. Okay, there you go. Good. Right, that's all it takes. No, seriously, there's people. Okay, there's always the people that have things. You know, I have to go pick up my daughter from school. I'm taking care of my mother, and she has to go to the doctor or something like that. There's just legitimate reasons for people to have to. I can't contribute this or here.
Again, yeah, understood.
There's always, you can usually find other ways to do
it. But in this situation that I'm talking about with the ticket, it literally sat open for 6 months. You did not have life emergencies every day for 6 months that meant you couldn't do 10 minutes.
You're assuming, though, that the person has control over what goes into their backlog. They may not. They may be given these 4 tickets every sprint or this 6 or whatever. This is your thing. And it could be that someone is very carefully crafting what it is they see and what they don't see so that they're never distracted. And that actually happens quite a lot. Agile. It's easy to fall into these patterns for Agile.
Yeah, except
to do that.
In this case, it was all in Jira. And
right. Yeah.
Again,
it's captured in Jira doesn't mean it's
right. But again, we're talking about a 6 month period that 10 minutes couldn't be done. That's very different than, okay, yes, this ticket is going to take a couple weeks.
I'm also very guilty of thinking, oh, it'll only take you 10 minutes. But
no, this really literally was. It was changing text on a website.
Oh.
And I had given them the text it needed to be.
That's disappointing.
So, like, all you had to do was go in and change it.
Yeah, periodically, I try and go back through. Yes, we do use Jira. Oh, horror. I actually don't have the opposition to it that you do. I find it distasteful at times, but it does accomplish things. Anyway, I try to go through and look at our open tickets and be like, that's kind of an easy one to knock off. And what ends up happening over time is all the easy ones do get closed, the 10-minute ones. And the ones that look like they are 10 minutes, but they're actually 5 hours.
Yeah, they linger.
Now you gotta go dive in. Those linger.
Yeah.
So for someone who doesn't know that it's going to take the extra 5 hours, they'd be like, why is that not being done? So I don't have a good way to communicate that outside.
Well,
I guess
see,
really
I think
the only way there is just diminish the importance of Jira.
Okay.
Right?
So,
and just get rid of all the reporting.
No, I want to disagree with that because I don't actually dislike Jira. I dislike the way people use Jira.
Okay. That's well put.
And
yes.
If there's that 10 minute task that you thought was going to be 10 minutes and then you realized, oh crap, this is going to take a week. Like, leave a damn comment that says that.
That's exactly. That's like, what the comments.
It's when
for.
You don't do that, or you know, the other thing that annoys me is I mean, let me be careful of how I want to say this is, as you are aware, Jira has the ability to log time.
Yes, it does.
So this is great. You know, it automatically does that crap when you click the buttons. Is then when you have to log your time in another application.
Oh.
And then, hold on, this one place infuriated me. So you use Jira to actually do the ticket work. You had to log your time, I forget what it is, in another application, okay? And then, wait, we're not even done. At the end of every 2 week period, you had to send an email to one of the managers with what you did over that 2 weeks.
Oh.
I am.
What's the point of putting it in Jira then?
Not only that, or whatever. I'm logging everything in Jira. Like, you could go on the calendar and see everything I've done and how much time I've spent on each ticket and all the thing. But no, that wasn't good enough. Yeah. I had to put it in this other program. And then that program wasn't good enough. I had to then email it too. And it's like, literally, you can create a Jira query that you just paste in and click boom, and there's your report. But that, no, you can't do that. You've got to use this other stuff.
Ticket, latest comment, whatever. Ticket status, something like that. Yeah, there's lots of ways to do this.
He could automate. They could have somebody come in who's like a Jira query wizard and be like, these are the strings that you put in, and then like auto create the charts and the graphs and all that. So the guy literally just has to log in, click the button on his custom dashboard, and then boom, there's the reports, there's the pie charts, there's the graphs, there's all the things he wanted. But instead, the individual employees were having to do this three times. And it's like, this is horrible. You are burning so much time of the developers who should be doing development, because one manager wants pretty graphs and wants everyone to spend three times as much time than just him clicking a button.
Okay, so not having been a manager, I can't really put myself in their shoes effectively, but I have to guess that some managers, like, they're not going to get what they need from the report, or what they think they're not going to get what they need from the report. The report doesn't tell them. So let me ask, if I tell you to retell something that you experienced, the way you tell it says a lot, just as much as the words you use, right? So I'm telling you about the thing, but also the way I'm telling you about that thing gives a lot of information too. So I can see the value of, as much as I would find it distasteful, write down all the things you did, put it into a document for me. I would glean more information from that, right? Now, sometimes you're going to get, like, the gruff guys who are like, this ticket, I closed it. This ticket,
well,
I closed it.
Well, that's what ended up, this, I couldn't, but see, that's it. What ended up happening, is that's what most people just did. It's like, here's the technical log of what I did. Because they're engineers. Like, this is how they think.
We've already done this. We've already even captured it for you. Just go look.
We've done it twice at this point. I'm not turning this into a storybook hour.
Right. So I'm trying to give the benefit of the doubt to such people. But it's really difficult for me to do so, because it's like, just go look. You don't even have to be a Jira wizard to be able to pull out these tickets. Like, just look at, they make it easy. You go to the query thing, right? Open issues. This person closed in the last 2 weeks. They even have like a button, closed in the last 2 weeks or something. Like, that's it. Or worked in the last 2 weeks.
Jira has really powerful metric system built into it.
It does. It does.
Like, yeah, you have to set it up once. But if you don't know how to do, if your organization doesn't have somebody that knows how to do that, you can contract somebody for like a week that really knows Jira to come in and set up all those fancy little things so all the data points get pulled in and stuff. So then you get wonderful metrics that you can then operate off of. And like, that's good for the business, because then you can see, you know, this is a feature that we were going to add, which we thought was going to require X amount of developer time. And we can see that it's actually taking three times what we estimated. So like, what is there a problem here? Is something else going on? Let's investigate this. Like, that's good data that your company should be operating on.
Right. Exactly.
But, yeah. That's why I get frustrated with Jira, because so many places use it badly.
I just like it. Just stopping there. We so many things left unsaid that we could pile on that we're choosing not to, right? No, but I don't even remember how we got into this, honestly. But this has been cathartic to get some of this out, you know, just like this frustration. Because I really do feel a lot of times, and a lot of the places I've worked have been so siloed. Like, several of them are like, I know we're siloed. We need to unsilo things. I'm like, well, then stop doing this shit, you know? This right here. Stop doing this. But
so I have been at organizations before that used absolutely different, completely software packages for tracking stuff. So, like, one part of the company would use, like Bugzilla for tracking. Another would use Jira. Another would use Basecamp. Like, these aren't even like the same platform. They're literally completely different platforms.
I can see that if you're acquiring pieces of the company, or you bought the small company, you stick it in with the other dev teams and it's its own dev team. I could see that maybe, but at some point you would think they would merge there.
No, so this place, it grew out of when the company started small, they had, you know, a couple people doing individual departments, and those people just did what they liked because it's what they knew and what they were effective at. And then just over the years, those initial choices have metastasized into now you have organizational tumors that are completely disconnected.
I like that description.
You know, you guys could do some amazing work if you all were on the same page.
Probably.
But you're not.
Yeah. 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 I'm willing to bet that a lot of our listeners have at least one or two things in this episode that they can empathize with, honestly. Probably many. I imagine there's a lot. And I don't want to say like solidarity with all our listeners, but I kind of have an idea that a lot of our listeners are stuck in these kinds of situations or have been in these kind of Kafka-esque dev team situations, that kind of stuff. So I'd like to hear some of what our listeners have to share. Just unload on us. Maybe just begin conversations about this, right? So I'd like, so many things I could share about, but I want to see what the tone is of our listeners and how they choose to respond first before I start sharing things, right? So send us your feedback. I bet a lot of our listeners have experiences similar to what we have. I'm not like trying to create a gripe out session for everybody, but it is quite cathartic to just be like, yes, you were in a similar situation. I understand. So share that with us. I think probably the best way there would be interactively in our Telegram or Matrix channels. But if you've had some really terrible dev experiences, or you were like victim of siloization, or if you were a victim of exploitation, I bet that's happened a lot too. You know, you can start the conversation in our Telegram and Matrix channels. You can send an email in to JT at Mindrip Media. You can also send a message straight from Fireside if you like. Lots of ways to reach out to us. There's also Twitter, although I don't think that's seen much action recently. So maybe someone send us a tweet.
Yeah, tweet me. Hit me up.
A tweet.
Call it your boy.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, perfect. So share with us what you have.